I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. While nothing can replace good common sense when it comes to safety while traveling, it sure is a welcome benefit to drive into a city or town that you've never visited and arrive at your end destination without ever studying, unfolding a paper map, or printing out the directions. Today on this special episode of the show, we're going to listen back to topics about innovation and tech in our region, beginning with navigational apps. You've no doubt heard the true story that someone's GPS mapping device told them to drive into a lake, and they did it. Well, not so long ago, that actually happened when some Connecticut visitors did indeed drive their borrowed Jeep directly onto Lake Champlain because they say they were just doing what the navigational app told them to do. And we as a society put a lot of trust in our tech aids. At least one study at University College London shows that some important functions in our brains actually seem to shut off or not get activated at all when we're using these navigational tools. Plus, Vermont's a difficult place for these apps to function. In addition to lakes, we have a lot of dirt roads, snowmobile trails, logging and ski trails. And because apps rely heavily on user feedback, the response from our more sparsely populated region may not reach critical mass. So today we'll hear more about navigational apps and how well they function, or don't, in our state. In a conversation last year, I spoke with cartographer and analyst Bill Morris, who works at the Burlington-based data analytics firm Faraday. I asked Morris to give us his take on the Connecticut tourists who, after using an app called Waze, took a wrong turn and ended up on frozen Lake Champlain. I asked him, how hard should we be on these people?
Be very easy on them. Just reading the description of the situation, it sounds like the police were as well. It sounds like the conditions were truly bad. Just like a
foggy,
really deep
dark fog, yeah.
Rain. And I can't really imagine the sensation of driving onto ice from a ramp like that. But I would imagine the terror that would hit under circumstances like that would be pretty intense. So I'd be pretty forgiving of those folks.
All right. Forgiving because the conditions were bad and that's a scary experience for anyone. But should they be forgiven for relying on their technology to quite that extent?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. That situation in particular might not be as illustrative of the broader dependence that we're getting on our devices as others, particularly because it does look like the Waze app, by all descriptions, malfunctioned.
And this is Waze, W-A-Z-E-E, and it's an app, like it's a sat nav app that people use.
Correct. It was it started as an independent crowdsourced traffic app built by an Israeli company, and then it was purchased by Google in 2013. But it is one of the standard applications that drivers use for this sort of thing. But again, that specific situation with those folks visiting from Connecticut, it was just bad conditions. And if they had been using a paper map, the standard Vermont roadmap, for instance, it wouldn't have helped them because it doesn't show that level of detail. In fact, that's one of the great benefits of a mobile navigation app is it shows you any level of detail you need.
So why then, though, you know, if we can't use these this latest incident as sort of a standard, it does seem like people often use navigational tools to a certain point and like shut off their brain. You know, it's not so bad as driving into a lake, but driving someplace that you know you shouldn't. Or we got a listener who sent us a sign that says, do not trust your GPS. Do not drive here. Or Smuggler's Notch, which tells truck drivers. And there's some work being done to try to fix the Smuggler's Notch problem. But, you know, you can have blaring signs flashing saying, don't go here. Your GPS is wrong. And people still go.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm certainly inclined to believe the results of the study that you mentioned, that the way that we just cognitively process the world around us is certainly changing, particularly when we just have a screen that tells us your next turn is a right turn. It's going to come right up and this is what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole different paradigm than before your trip, planning it out turn by turn on a paper map.
Or even really just having a map with you and trying to say, OK, well, is that the street? Is that the street? No. OK, that's the street. You know, if you're looking at all of your surroundings that carefully, it makes sense that it would do different things in your brain.
Yeah, certainly. But I would argue that it really opens up the world in a way that might not have before. You take an example of navigating in Boston, where people seem to remove street signs to make things more difficult. Or even, you know, driving around Essex County, where there's no particular indication of which road you're turning onto. The ability to explore places like that is opened up to us by a digital paradigm like this. And that comes with all sorts of problems, as we've seen, and I'm sure as we're going to hear too.
Yes, I mean, clearly you're defending this technology, and I don't mean to cast aspersions on it because it's really remarkable. I mean, the places we can go that we couldn't go before or couldn't go as easily or couldn't go as quickly, you know, if you had to go find a map and figure out how to get to the place, that's different than saying, oh, I'd like to go here right now and typing something into your phone and having that map in front of you. So
yeah.
It is remarkable.
It is, certainly. And I definitely I can't say this frequently enough, and I hope to repeat it a couple of times in the course of this conversation. Nothing replaces good critical judgment, whether you have an app telling you which way to go or a paper map telling you which way to go, or your aunt who's given you directions on a piece of paper. You still have to have a good sense of navigational judgment associated with that.
Given your personal interests and your professional interests and how much you love this stuff, have you ever taken the GPS instructions when you shouldn't have?
Oh, man. No, actually, just yesterday driving back from Lake Placid with my kids, I actually took a wrong turn because I thought that the GPS was wrong. ended up a half mile down a road before I realized that I should actually just trust the GPS.
That's why they say recalculating in such an annoyed voice.
Exactly.
They know you're
wrong. Totally. Yeah, we need to get your attention here. But I certainly have... I have trusted GPS turns that are maybe a little bit more subtly different than other directions, just the sort of thing where the shortest path isn't necessarily the quickest and the machine making that decision for you doesn't have all the information.
Mm-hmm. Or like in Vermont, there are a lot of mountain passes that close for the winter. And now, the technology is getting better and sometimes it will tell you that, but it didn't used to.
Well, actually, just as a test before coming in, I used two different apps. I used Google Maps, sort of a standard one, to try and navigate between Stone Mountain Resort and Smuggler's Notch Resort. And Google Maps very clearly showed the huge drive around through Morrisville, even though the indication was there that the two places were very close together, but also with a warning between them saying that closed road in the winter. So Google, I think, after maybe a number of local complaints, has responded fairly well to that. But then I tried it against MapQuest, an old standard. Many of us used it for directions back in the early days of digital
Some
navigation.
Some of us still use it.
Right, yeah. Well, MapQuest, I mean, just in this case, I'm not sure I can recommend it because it suggests you take Route 108 right now to get from point to point.
All right. There you go. Don't use it.
Yeah. So there's wide variation as to how intelligently the applications we use can take in all sorts of different information like that. Google is known for its ability to subsume lots of info and create actionable data out of it. MapQuest, in this case, perhaps not so much.
Robert's calling in from East Montpelier.
We had a little different experience about 5 years ago driving to East Buxton, Maine, I believe. We got within about a half mile of our destination, and we were directed down a dirt road, which we took, came to a river, and we were told that our destination was 100 yards across. We chose to back up and find an alternate route.
Okay.
I think perhaps a little different result than the individual that drove across the ice the other night. So.
Robert, thanks for your call. Thanks for your experience. And Bill, this gives you a chance to say the thing that you wanted to say several times during this program.
Yes, always trust your own judgment.
Well done
Critical
on that,
thinking
Robert.
Skills.
Let's go to Ron in Rutland. Hey, Ron, you're on the air.
Yeah, I have maybe a similar example, but I just want to say I work in IT, and I do – maybe I'm splitting hairs, but I do take a distinction between the app or the program versus the data. Now, like maybe for MapQuest or Google, you know, it's one and the same, but maybe there's apps that are using some other third party. Maybe they're using Google in different ways. Who knows? But in the case I was talking about is OnStar. We bought a car like 3 years ago, and we have the OnStar service, and they wanted us to try the upgrade. So we had it for free for a month, and we were going to a restaurant in Castleton, which we knew where it was, but we tried it out. So we weren't going on any dirt roads or anything like that. And, you know, it's basically Highway 4, the first exit in Castleton. We could have gone to the second exit, but it told us to go to the first. And we thought, okay, it's going to make us a turn right toward the college. It said turn left. And then we got, like, you know, a half mile out of town. the other way, and it said, okay, you have arrived at your destination. So we called OnStar. They said, oh, we'll call the restaurant. So we had arrived in the parking lot as the OnStar was calling us back. And the lady at the restaurant said, you weren't the first person that has had that problem. So obviously we didn't buy the upgrade package. So.
Well, Ron, thanks for your call. And, I saw Bill raising two thumbs in the air when you said it's not the individual apps necessarily who should be to blame, but the data they're using.
Yeah, it's an interesting scene in the industry at the moment because there's a lot of vertical integration going on between all the way from app down to data. Google and Apple are big examples of this, of owning both their own data sets and their own client, the way that we interact with that data. But yeah, there are certainly others. MapQuest in particular draws from places like the Wikipedia of maps, OpenStreetMap. There's also TomTom. There are a whole bunch of players in the industry who either provide data or provide a service on top of that. What it sounds like you're describing there, particularly if it's happened multiple times, is that OnStar has what's called a geocoding error, where the process of geocoding is assigning a set of geographic coordinates, latitude and longitude, to an address. It's sort of widely regarded that Google has the best database of geocoding in the world at this point. They're most likely to be able to say, here are the coordinates of the roof of this restaurant. Whereas others, they can be off by, in some cases, many miles, particularly if they're using some of the less accurate methods of finding those locations. So it just
Google is proprietary and nobody else can use
completely
it.
Completely proprietary. They offer application programming interfaces that let you access records like that one at a time, but only in the context of the apps that you try to build on top of them. They would never, for instance, give you a spreadsheet full of addresses and their coordinates. That's against their terms of use. So Google, Apple, many other providers are proprietary about how they treat this data, and there is a wide range of quality to those data sets.
We got a note from Mike who says, I am the last house on a private dead-end road. Technically, my road continues through the woods, but those houses farther down are accessed via a different road. Navigation platforms for years placed one of those houses in my driveway. For years, I had people show up at my house at all hours. I received their packages when couriers were lost. Recently, I contacted Google, Garmin, and MapQuest, and in a matter of weeks, it was all corrected. Those other houses are now accessed the correct way and not going to my house. And Mike says, people have the power to correct these issues.
It's true. Yeah. I'd say I think Google was probably quickest off the mark with this in having an interface that allowed you to correct an incorrect geocode. I guess this is still sort of a geocoding problem. To some extent, it happens every time you open the app. If you navigate to a location, you arrive at what the app says is the location. Frequently, you'll see, is this correct? And if it's not, you'll have the opportunity to fix that. The opportunity to fix these things one by one is there, but it's a very daunting task. And the companies that are approaching massive data sets like these are using a variety of different tactics, and the input of individuals is only one of them.
We got a note from Michael who says, years ago I lived in Clarendon. I was trying to use my GPS to get home from somewhere in the middle of nowhere. The GPS directed me to get on what amounted to a logging trail. Eventually, despite driving a four-wheel drive pickup, I found myself unable to continue and turned right back before I would have gotten stuck. Dennis says, like cell phone coverage, doesn't the terrain present obstacles?
Definitely. Yeah. We don't have a unique set of circumstances in Vermont. There are other mountainous rural places in the country, but we certainly have to learn to live with them. The increasing availability of offline data seems to be the catch-all solution that most providers are using for rural areas with poor cell phone coverage.
But do you have to think of that in advance?
Exactly. Yeah. It's fundamentally limited by the fact that if you're at your house starting your navigation and you're connected to Wi-Fi, Google Maps, for instance, will prompt you, this goes through a poor coverage area. Would you like to download the directions for offline use? But if you have to do that halfway through your trip, you're completely out of luck.
I'll just jump in here to say that Mark posts on that exact problem and says, the biggest problem I've had with GPS and navigation in Vermont is the lack of signal in many areas, such that my navigation app can't recalculate a route if I do make a wrong turn and deviate from the preloaded route.
Yeah, we Vermonters are not the first use case that the developers of the major navigation applications think of. So they're slow in coming to it, but bit by bit, you can see they sort of throw shims underneath our problems to try and fix them. So in that case, I've noticed that Google Maps and Apple Maps, their offline caching will now include a buffered area alongside your existing route. So if you happen to make a wrong turn, it has the ability in some cases to recalculate during the trip, even if you're out of cell phone service. But these are just incredibly complex user cases. And yeah, as I mentioned, we're not always the first ones they're thinking of as they plan how to navigate from point A to point B inside of San Francisco. The idea of having to download stuff for offline use later is asking it's asking kind of a lot from users. But it's also increasing their cartographic and digital literacy in a certain way, particularly if you live in rural Vermont and you know you're going to be offline at some point, just having a sense of, yeah, I better bring this map with me. I would argue that that's not terribly different than bringing a folded map with you.
We're talking about GPS mapping. We're talking about our own behaviors, and we're looking at how this all works in a rural state like Vermont. And we've gotten a lot of comments and anecdotes from you. Ari wrote in to say, a couple years ago, I hosted a friend from the West Coast who is in Boston for a couple of days before he went to a wedding in Vermont. I asked him where the wedding was. I don't know, he said, I'll just put it in my phone. I laughed. I don't think that's a good strategy. There's not much cell reception in Vermont. What do you mean, like dead zones, he said? No, like the entire state. He said he was headed to Hosmer something. Having Nordic skied extensively in Craftsbury, I knew exactly where he was going and exactly how much cell reception there'd be for the last 30 miles of the drive. None. My advice, make sure you have the directions in your phone, draw out a map as backup, and no, I don't think you'll be able to stream the college football game on your phone either. Ba-dum-bum. Thank you, Ari. And we got a note from Jared in Lincoln who says, my first real job was at AAA in 1995, and I used to create triptychs by hand. It was a fun job, and even today my brain is like a map. I miss the days of people using their brains and a good road atlas for directions. Two summers ago, I brought my nephews on a cross-country trip, and they were amazed that I always knew where we were going, and where we had been without ever using an app. One of those nephews now loves maps, and I gave him his own collection of Delorme road atlases for Christmas last year. There is hope, Jared says. I have a feeling Bill might take exception with the idea that the only hope is in paper maps. Again, nothing replaces your own good sense and judgment. And to that note, Lisa says, how will self-driving cars deal with GPS errors? It's truly frightening to imagine a self-driving car following some of the instructions my GPS has given me.
I don't mean to be too extreme in my statement here, but I don't think Vermont is ready for self-driving cars comprehensively.
Well, in fact, we just had a report from VPR's Howard Weiss-Tisman this morning that says Vermont's one of only about 20 states that haven't taken any steps yet to deal with the oncoming driverless car phenomenon.
It's excellent that that process is underway, that
yeah,
there's
V-Trans
some sense of policy. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
You have two angles of it. There's legal policy. How do we deal with the fact that a robot is driving a car? That's a whole thicket of questions on one side. But then you have the practical implications of it, which fall into the infrastructure category. I mean, if you've driven Pine Street in Burlington recently, you can't see lines anywhere. And that's something that of all the array of sensors that a self-driving car is bringing to bear, the ability to read lines on the ground is something that is frequently like the bedrock of that technology. Don't cross the white line. Don't cross the double yellow line.
I live on a dirt road.
Exactly.
We have no lines.
Yeah. So I was describing this to someone else. There's an array of sensors, like I mentioned, and an array of approaches that a self-driving car can use to get from point to point. It's GPS and a digital road network. That's one way. But that's not going to necessarily prevent a car from, you know, veering onto a shoulder because the data is just not precise enough. To that end, you have a bunch of cameras, whether they're LiDAR sensors or just optical cameras. It varies from car technology to car technology, but that's the sort of thing that is supposed to actually keep you within the lines on the road. So there's a certain flexibility to these things, but they're all interdependently used in good self-driving car systems. If any one of those approaches fails, maybe another one picks up the slack. But Vermont seems to me to be the sort of place where all of those approaches might fail at the same time. Just poor GPS coverage, no lines on the road, and inability of, you know, a machine learning algorithm to communicate with a central hub to be able to interpret features. I think that self-driving cars in Vermont are going to be fascinating once they arrive and they start working with them. But yeah, I don't think we're there yet. I certainly love Atlases and Gazetteers, and I think having the ability to use both is going to serve drivers well throughout the future.
All right. Well, you know, this is an interesting topic and certainly a developing one given technology and given self-driving cars and the future and Vermont's roads. Bill Morris, cartographer, senior analyst at the data analytics firm Faraday. Thank you very much, as always, for being on the show.
Thank you, Jane.
Today, we are examining the effects of recent tech innovations as they ripple across our region. Earlier, we listened to a conversation I had with a local cartographer who told us about how navigational apps can be a huge challenge in a rural place like Vermont. Now, we're going to listen back to an interview we did about three local innovators who are making STEM field careers more accessible to people who are blind. They did it by creating a drawing tablet. Now, people who are blind often face a barrier to entry in the science and technology fields. The challenge they face comes from not being able to do the drawing and drafting required for engineering or even some mathematics that require graphing. So in 2011, with support from the National Federation for the Blind, a UVM student and two UVM engineering professors started a company that makes a drawing tablet capable of creating raised lines that blind people can touch. They also figured out a way to make an effective eraser. Now the Burlington Company's products are used in schools across the country, and they're transitioning into also publishing curricula that can be used with the tablets. The company is called Easy. Its vice president and one of the three co-founders is Mike Coleman. When Coleman joined us to talk about the drawing tablet, he described what they look like and how they actually work.
It's somewhat like a clipboard, but it's akin to pencil and paper. What we use are these plastic sheets, which is a raised line drawing medium that's like paper. But you put it into this sketch pad, a cover comes down, holds it tightly. And when you draw with a stylus, it can be any pointed object, actually. A ballpoint pen works, or a pencil.
Fingernail?
Fingernail works. A fork, if you want to make parallel lines. And it leaves raised lines instead of grooves. So you might think if I'm embossing something, you might have to turn it over because you're making a raised line, but it's because you've left a groove and you have to turn it over to feel it. But as you draw, you can feel the lines the same way you can see lines as you draw with a pen or pencil.
Somebody in one of the articles about your company described it as like an Etch-a-Sketch on steroids. Does that seem like a fitting definition to you? I mean, it seems a little bit
not exactly. I mean, yeah. I like to just think of it as analogous to pencil and paper. It is really one of the only quick and easy mediums or methods of sketching or drawing that's like pen and pencil and paper for the sighted.
And this ability to erase, how did you make that happen? Because it seems like, you know, just in your mind thinking about it, it would be hard to get rid of a raised, you know, sort of physically raised edge.
Yeah, it's a really good question. In fact, this all started as a student engineering project at UVM, and it came through the National Federation of the Blind. And they were looking for, in general, improved tactile graphics technology for the blind. And one of the things they were looking for was the equivalent of the rubber eraser for pencil and paper. And the task in this first year project in 2008 was to come up with some way to erase. And as it turns out, the plastic sheets, which is the drawing medium, is a thermoplastic, and it can be heated and reshaped any number of times. And so what we invented in the end was what you might call a point or spot iron. It's a repurposed flashlight, actually, where the tip has been modified to have a tiny heating element. It's about the same temperature as a hot glue gun. When you erase with the same kind of motion that you use for an eraser on paper, you can flatten the line by ironing it.
How long do you have to wait before you can draw on it again? Is it pretty immediate?
It's instantaneous. Yeah. And you can draw and erase any number of times. In fact, in some ways, it's more robust than pencil and paper, which eventually gets kind of smeared, or you can snag the paper and so on.
When this got started, as you mentioned, it was a student project, and the three of you worked on it and then discovered, you know, okay, well, this could actually be a company. But did you have a sense that this was going to be something that would be picked up by schools and really a useful tool? Or was it sort of an academic exercise at the first, and now it's this, you know, sort of burgeoning company?
Well, you know, we really didn't have a choice in a way in how this came about, in the sense that right from the start, this was a design solution for something proposed by the National Federation of the Blind. It wasn't something that we thought, oh, this could be an interesting area to get into.
Right. You had the problem in front of you and your job was to solve
it. Right. So the senior engineering experience in design, which was Mike Rosen was teaching that course. The idea of the course is to partner with outside entities, and the NFB became one of them. And the idea is to have a more real life interaction in a design process for the students. So it's not just trying to cook up ideas. So did we have some sense that it would catch on? From the start, it was made clear to us by the NFB that they wanted improved tactile graphics tools and opportunities for the blind, and that a big part of it was education. A lot of that's missing in blind students and visually impaired students' education, and they're often told to skip it and so on. So we knew there was a need and a desire. The NFB is totally behind it. Teachers of the visually impaired are on board with it. We've worked with schools for the blind and also TVIs that work with mainstream students. We knew that there was this need and desire, and we knew that from the beginning.
One of the things that you're doing now is actually creating the curricula to go along with these tablets for schools that are using them. What kind of curricula?
Well, as it turns out, you know, in curriculum for the sighted, right? There's lots of requirements for drawing to be part of their learning experience. So we're just trying to, you know, to be compliant, you know, to help the schools and teachers be compliant with the American Disabilities Act for one thing. So if there's something available to the sighted, it needs to be available to the blind. And as long as the expectations are there and the opportunities the blind can draw. So we just follow what's there for the sighted. So anything from connect the dots to mazes to tic-tac-toe at the youngest ages all the way up to algebra. So graphing on number lines or graphing points on an XY plot to doing geometry constructions. We just look at what's out there, and we try to develop content that's can be used by the blind.
I think the three of you who founded the company are all sighted people, right? So how have you worked with people who are blind and visually impaired to fine-tune this and to figure out what's needed for people who are actually using it?
So right from the start, I mentioned our involvement with the NFB. So Al Maneki, who is a mathematician, PhD, number theory is his area of endeavor, was the mentor on these projects. And he's been passionate about improving the opportunities for the blind in this area. And especially for him, he couldn't do geometry or sort of these pictorial kinds of mathematics and just thought of it as unacceptable. Since the beginning, he's engaged us in working with the blind community. And every year since 2008, we've been going to the National Federation of the Blind National Convention, which is always in one place like Orlando. And then we've gone to a lot of state conventions. We got a grant from the NIH.
The National Institutes of Health.
National Institutes of Health, a small technology transfer research grant. And the collaborators that we contracted included the NFB, Vermont Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired, Louisiana Center for the Blind, Perkins School for the Blind, Texas School for the Blind and Visually Impaired. But not only that, we were working with the divisions in Pearson Publishing, who are trying to make accessible content, and also American Institutes for Research, which does standardized exam digital and print platforms. So we've worked as closely as we can with the community to create this content and to answer their needs.
Well, it's really neat to learn about it, and we'll post a picture of what it looks like on our webpage at vpr.net. Mike Coleman is one of the three founders of EASY. It's E-A-S-Y, which makes these tactile drawing tablets for people who are blind. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you again for the invitation and for talking with me.
That was Mike Coleman talking about a sketch pad for drawing graphs that his company created for people who are blind or have sight impairments. Next up in our Innovation and Tech Show, we'll revisit a recent story about a South Burlington and Plattsburgh-based company that has created a prototype electric air taxi. The vehicle has been going through testing at the Plattsburgh Air Force Base, and we invited aerospace engineer Kyle Clark, who's leading the team at Beta Technologies, to tell us more about this eVTOL, or electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicle.
It's a vehicle that switches modes of flight from going vertical to going horizontal. And we can talk about how that becomes a really efficient vehicle to get from place to place.
So, I mean, are we thinking about basically a helicopter that's modified to be an electric helicopter? I mean, is that what you would picture here?
Yeah, that's logically the first step. And there's folks that have electrified helicopters. We evaluated the probability of taking batteries and putting them on a helicopter. But the problem with a helicopter is it's terribly inefficient in flying forward, although it's very efficient in going straight up. On the contrary, an airplane is very efficient going forward, but of course it needs a runway and infrastructure. So we designed and built a proof-of-concept vehicle that switches modes while it's in the air. It takes off like a helicopter straight up in the air, and then it transitions through our big articulating outriggers to turn into an airplane, and then it flies forward. So
it's a transformer.
It's an airborne transformer, exactly. And naturally, there's the only thing holding back electric aircraft, and everybody knows this from picking up a radio even, is batteries and battery energy density. And minimizing the amount of batteries or maximizing the amount of energy you can get out of those batteries is an important part of the design. And the other half of the equation is how you use that energy. So taking off vertically allows you to get to where you're going, so you don't need to switch transport modes. And flying on a wing like an airplane allows you to use that energy, that very precious energy in the batteries, much more efficiently. So you can go a long distance at high speeds.
So you've had to tackle a number of different problems to try to figure this out. You just mentioned them. I mean, one of them is battery power and strength. Another is how heavy those batteries are. I mean, you just think about some of the battery-powered cars. And then that energy expended by getting a plane up into the air. So you've not only thought about these things, you've actually built a prototype and you're actually flying it?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have a 4,000-pound prototype. It's effectively a two-seater now, with a 34-foot wingspan, and we started flying in Burlington in hover flying, and now we've moved to Plattsburgh, where there's more room at the old Air Force Base, to transition from a helicopter to an airplane and back to a helicopter again.
You were doing this in secret until recently. Was it actually a secret? I mean, people must have seen this thing going and thought, what the heck is that?
Yeah, that's exactly what they said. There was a series of pictures that were posted online, screaming how silly the thing was, of course, not understanding what we were trying to accomplish when we were flying at Burlington. But I wouldn't say we were doing it in secret. What we were doing is staying very focused on an objective. And the quote, flying car industry is exploding with folks that have pretty pictures and CAD models of designs. And we took a different track. We said, let's do it for real, and then we'll tell people about it. So we formed a team of probably the best engineers Vermont has ever seen come together, former owners and founders of many of the high technological businesses in town here. We joined up and over the course of 10 months conceived, built, and flew this first of aircraft. And then we told the world about it. And when we did that, the response was, wow, it is real. And we've gotten a flood of interest. And that's actually earned us the right to build a certifiable version of this.
You know, one of the reasons that some of those companies might only have their designs that they're touting is because they don't have the funding to actually build it. And that hasn't been a problem for you. You do have backing to build this vehicle. With what purpose?
So we're really lucky in that we found a customer that's in a space where we can break through that certification barrier a little bit easier. They're actually moving organs between hospitals and manufacturing centers and refurbishing the organs while they're doing this.
You're talking about human organs. This is human organ transplant. And in some cases, synthetic organs are what we're talking about.
Yeah, in the future, it'll be synthetic organs, exactly. And in this particular customer, as far as I know, we actually have the largest and most meaningful contract in all of the eVTOL space from this particular customer, who's a forward-thinking, the CEO of United Therapeutics, Martine Rothblatt, the founder of SiriusXM Radio. She has been a thought leader in all of these interesting technologies. And when she came to us and said, how would we elicit critical thinking in this? And we said, we're going to build it and do it. She just gave us a fist pump and within 10 hours said, you're on. And we were off to the races building this first vehicle. But yeah, the end game is to move organs as the first customer. But naturally, the aircraft is super versatile and it has applications in search and rescue, medevac, and ultimately what everybody's calling urban mobility, where we're adding the Z dimension to the X and Y plane that we operate in right now. And it'll, as she says, move the world from flatland to sphereland.
So what do you mean? Like air taxis? Like instead of when I call for an Uber, those few times that I'm out in Burlington, I could actually call for an Uber Air?
Absolutely.
Something like that is what you're
thinking?
So
they call it Uber Elevate.
Oh, I didn't even know it was a real thing.
It's a real thing, and Uber is actually one of the thought leaders in this space. And there are a variety of others that are doing it as well. And, yeah, that's the idea around urban mobility to reduce congestion, but also for critical flights to move people around more efficiently. You know, Elon Musk wants to form the Boring Company and go underground, and we believe that it's a little less friction above ground.
Yes, so to speak. So when you envision this future, though, with all of these flying vehicles, how would we have to change – I mean, I know regulatory hurdles are one thing, and I don't mean that. But, I mean, how would we even have to change how we think about roads and rules in the air? I mean, that goes along with a lot of – I'm picturing, Jetsons and the future. But without a road that we know what it is, just when you think about the future 30, 50, 70 years from now, how do you think of us having those rules?
Well, the interesting thing is we look at it, and the easy solution is to make highways in the sky or tubes through the air that are defined in direction and altitude and sequenced as the aircraft go through them. But that's overly simplistic in many cases. We have the ability to dynamically adapt to whatever needs are happening. We've all driven into Boston, and you see the center lane shifts from inbound to outbound with the traffic, right? Well, imagine that with multiple dimensions, right? So now we have the ability to dynamically reroute the flow of traffic in three dimensions, actually a fourth dimension if you include time, through space. And that can be done with a series of very high-speed algorithms that safely keep the appropriate spacing and put the aircraft where they need to be.
So in the meantime, before we get there, you have a cross-country flight planned for this summer to actually test out whether this could actually work in the short term.
Absolutely. There's, again, a lot of folks telling stories about what they're going to do. And we believe that flying this aircraft across the country is a real truth teller because you have to manage all the regulatory, all the local jurisdictions that don't want batteries over their head. And then the day-after-day reliability of the aircraft. And a long time ago, a doctor from Vermont, Horatio Jackson, in 1903, was the first to drive an automobile across the United States. And he's credited with changing the mindset of the automobile as a toy for the rich to a utilitarian tool. And that's what we want to do with our cross-country flight.
Well, we look forward to hearing how it goes and maybe talking to you again. Kyle Clark is an aerospace engineer leading the team at Beta Technologies, which is working on developing an eVTOL, or electric vehicle takeoff and landing aircraft. Team has been doing its research in Plattsburgh and South Burlington. Thank you very much for sharing it with us, Kyle.
Thanks
appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
That was Kyle Clark, leading the team at Beta Technologies, a Plattsburgh and South Burlington-based firm, telling us about the eVTOL, or electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicle. And that's our show for today. You can find links and more information about all of these stories at vpr.org.